These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. These lectures are titled, The Long Shadow of the Ancient Greek World, Part 4. Lecture 37, Types of Cases, Sycophants and Pretrial.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm going to examine some of the public and private types of cases and procedures that existed in the developed legal system of Athens. I'm also going to consider the odious sycophants or blackmailers who were castigated by society and yet were still part of the judicial process. And finally, I'm going to talk about the lead up to the actual trial, including witness testimony and the preliminary hearing. Then I'm going to try out a heresy on you. Wouldn't be the first time. And this heresy is about the origins of the modern attorney. Now, all of this will set us up, I hope, for our next lecture, which covers the actual trial from its start to its conclusion. Let's begin with the types of cases. A private case was called a dike idia, and a public case was called a dike demosia. Now the former, the dike idia, picks up on the word idios, which means one's own, or only, or even oneself, hence our word idiomatic, for example. The latter, the dike demosia, picks up on the word demos, that's the people as a whole, the community. A private case clearly affected a smaller number of disputants, and a charge had to be made by one of those affected against someone else. However, a public case affected the state as a whole, and any adult male citizen could bring a suit against the alleged criminal. Public cases included, obviously, treason, or embezzlement of public funds, since these affected the running of the city the most. However, there were crimes that were considered offensive against the people as a whole, against the community, which we might not consider in the same way. And these included adultery, something we've talked about, hubris, and maltreating an orphan. Before too long, a private case was identified simply by the word dike, and a public case came to be identified by the word graphe. The last word, graphe, means writing, and it perhaps originally the charge, being more serious before because it affected the community, had to be made in writing. By the 380s, though, everything was in writing. That was the time when there was a change from oral to written testimony. And this type of testimony, like depositions and statements by character witnesses, was read out by a clerk of the court during the actual trial. Although cases were generally divided into private, that's dike, and public, that's graphe ones, the line between each one was not always clear-cut, and some crimes fall into categories that strike us today as rather odd. For example, premeditated homicide was tried under the dike phonou procedure. This was a private suit, whereas adultery or passing off illegitimate children as legitimate Athenians was tried under the graphe xenias procedure, in other words, a public suit. This was the charge, by the way, graphe xenias, that was brought against Neaira and by extension her husband Stephanus, which we discussed in a previous lecture. That a homicide case was categorized as a dike is perhaps due to tradition. It's a throwback to Drakon's homicide law, which was made before the term graphe or writing came into being, and the Athenians simply carried on with that term for the sake of tradition. Now, in a dike, that's a private suit, the wronged party simply brought a suit against the alleged criminal. This could be settled either by the arbitration process, as we described in the last lecture, or by a trial if the arbitration process was not acceptable or either side didn't want to use it. The jury in private trials numbered from 201 to 501, depending on the type of crime or the monetary amount involved. And the penalties varied again depending on the crime, especially if money was involved. Usually a fine was the normal penalty, but obviously in more serious DK cases, like homicide, the penalty would be greater. Execution for premeditated homicide, for example. Agrafe was a much more serious matter because it affected the state, as we said. If a citizen wanted to charge a person with agrafe, then he had to use one of several procedures to initiate the case. And again, the procedure used depended on the nature of the charge. Some of the more regularly used procedures were apagoge, ephagesis, endexis, apagraphe, pharsis, esangelia, and probole. And I'll explain what each of these seven procedures, which are quite a mouthful, aren't they? I'll explain what each of them involved now. In an apagoge, a prosecutor himself arrested the accused person and led him straight off to prison. Here at the prison, the 11, that elected group of individuals who are in charge of the jail and of the prisoners in it, would then ensure that the accused didn't flee. As we said previously, the 11 are an enigmatic body. No one knows exactly when they were introduced or indeed why they numbered 11. It's not quite right to describe the 11 as a type of police force, although they did do this job. But they had other functions in the legal system as well, including this oversight of prisoners and also handing over condemned men to the executioner. The procedure called apagoge is somewhat similar to the citizen's arrest today. But what if the victim was too intimidated to try to arrest someone else? Then the person could resort to the ephagesis procedure, whereby a prosecutor, the victim, took the appropriate magistrate to the accused man and had that man arrested by the magistrate. Then there's the endexis procedure. Here the prosecutor accused someone before the appropriate magistrate, and then the accuser had the option of arresting the defendant. You can see there's not a lot between these various procedures, but there are subtle differences, aren't there? Now to the apagraphe and the pharsis procedures, which I'll run these two together. These were used when someone was accused of still owning property that belonged to the state. In other words, if someone had been found guilty on a previous charge, and had to hand over property to the state in the form of a fine, for example, but he hadn't yet done so, then he could be brought up on charges, apagraphe and pharsis. If successful, the accuser, that's the man who brought up the debtor on these charges, the accuser of a man like this got 75% of what the man was supposed to have paid under the apagraphe procedure. And he got 50% under the pharsis procedure. Now it's unclear why one procedure was worth less than the other. I mean, if you were sure that the man in your crosshairs had not surrendered property to the state, you'd probably want to bring an apagraphe against him and so get 75% of his property rather than just 50% under a pharsis. Now, I don't know the answer. Yes, there are even some things that I don't know the answer to. Nobody does. But it's possible that the type of property decided the procedure. Let's move to the next procedure, esangelia. This was more of a political charge. It's usually translated as impeachment, and it was often brought against officials suspected of corruption. These could be officials elected to regular political offices, like the archonships, or arbitrators, as we mentioned in the last lecture. The procedure, that's eisengelia, was not just aimed at those holding constitutional offices, however. It was used against people who maltreated orphans. Hence, when we use the term impeachment, we think of it in that narrower political sense as we do today, where we talk, for example, about impeaching a president. But the Athenians didn't have this narrow political sense to the word. And another translation which is often used of eisengelia is simply denunciation. And this may convey the meaning a little bit more clearly than impeachment. Our final procedure is probele. A probele was a case that was first heard in the assembly, and then if the assembly thought that the charge was justified, it referred the case to a law court. So in other words, the probele was like a preliminary verdict that was decided by the assembly. It was preliminary in the sense that it wasn't the final one, which was issued only by the court if the case got that far. Now, there's a very famous case dating from the year 348 when Demosthenes the orator was punched in the face by a man called Medias at a religious festival. Under Athenian law, this conduct at a religious gathering was illegal. It would have offended the gods. You didn't engage in fisticuffs whenever the gods were involved. So Demosthenes brought a probele against Medias. And we have Demosthenes' ultra-lengthy prosecution speech from that trial. It's one of the very few forensic speeches that have survived from Athens. We've got a lot of them, but we haven't got a huge amount. It's important to remember that nothing was cut in stone. Sometimes a person's crime might fall under a variety of laws. For example, some kinds of theft and homicide. In the case of theft, a man could be prosecuted under the apagoge or ephagesis procedures. Or he could even have a dike brought against him, which was called the dike klopes. And men accused of being sycophants or blackmailers, and I'll talk about this group in a moment, were tried under the probele procedure. So you can see that the legal system was very fluid, perhaps far more so than it is today. Now that we've summarized some of the judicial procedures by which a person might be accused, let's turn to the litigants. As we know, it was up to a private individual to bring a suit against someone, and for those individuals to speak on their behalf in court if the case got that far. The prosecutor might be the wronged person himself, or under Solon's law of third-party intervention, he might be a volunteer prosecutor. In other words, a person who is accusing someone on behalf of the victim. There were occasions when a person could not indict someone during the year, and certain cases couldn't be started except at specific times. And these included homicide suits, and I'd like to expand on this at this point now. Whereas today, someone can be accused of murder at any time, in classical Athens, a homicide case could only be brought in the first 7 months of the Attic year. Remember, the Attic year lasted for 10 months, so each month was roughly 6 weeks long. Now, why could you only prosecute someone for homicide in the first 7 months of the year and not the remaining three? Well, this was because the whole suit, from its inception to the actual trial, could take up to 4 months. What with sort of evidence and witness testimony and finding out all sorts of things, this is a capital charge. And homicide is obviously a very serious crime involving this capital punishment. It was thought then that the same magistrate who oversaw the start of the homicide case should see it through. But that magistrate would be unable to do this if the procedure started during those last 3 months of his office. Once that attic year came to an end, a new magistrate would take over. Now, we know so little about law elsewhere. It's often frustrating. However, we do know that in Sparta, capital cases took several days to be decided because the decision to condemn, once it had been carried out, couldn't be reversed as in non-capital cases. So the Athenians evidently thought about this as well. They realized the implications of finding somebody guilty on a capital charge and executing that person. You can bring someone back from exile, but you can't bring someone back from the dead. The same person who brought the indictment to the magistrate on the right day also had to ensure that the accused person would turn up on the same day. If the crime was a public one and he was game enough to go for an apagoge, the accuser issued an oral summons to the person along the lines of, "I summon you to appear before magistrate such and such on this particular day." And he would be accompanied by at least two people as witnesses. That way the accused person couldn't say, "Oh, well, I didn't know. He never came and told me when I was supposed to turn up." Now, when the day for the first hearing arrived, the person bringing the charge made a statement of his claim to the magistrate, which from about 380 was in writing, and he paid a fee to initiate the proceedings. We discussed the judicial powers of the magistrates, from archons to the state-appointed or public synagoroi, in the previous lecture, and how some of these were akin to public prosecutors as we think of them today. Included among these prosecutors is another group that are better dealt with in this lecture, and that is the sycophants. In a nutshell, they were blackmailers. They were men who would spy on others and then threaten to take them to court unless you paid them off. So sycophant obviously has a very different meaning today. We think of flatterer or toady than it did back then. Now, some crimes and procedures obviously appeal to sycophants, such as the apographe procedure by which the accuser got 75% of the convicted man's property, or pharsis, by which the accuser got 50%. The sycophants as a group probably arose out of Solon's volunteer prosecutors, in other words, the third party intervention. And they became notorious as the 5th century wore on, and especially in the 4th century. It seems that many sycophants prosecuted just for the sake of it, even if the misdeed wasn't great. Now, be honest, ladies and gentlemen, how many people have approached a four-way intersection with no other car in sight and you haven't brought your car to a complete halt before that stop sign? Well, I always do, of course. Hey, I'm on tape, I have to say that. Well, technically, this is breaking the law, isn't it? And in Athens, if you were spotted doing this, a sycophant would be after you like a shot. So it doesn't matter how minor the crime or how major. Now, needless to say, sycophancy was scorned by members of society. And that was probably why a man could be prosecuted for being a sycophant under the probule procedure. That's the one where the assembly first delivers a preliminary verdict, and then if it thinks the case has merit, it proceeds to a law court. And I think sycophants were prosecuted under the probule because of the involvement of the assembly. The sycophant would become the talk of several thousand people in an assembly, not just a few hundred jurors in a law court. And it may have been felt that having the assembly investigate a charge of sycophancy would be a deterrent to stop a sycophant's activities in the future. Everybody would know your name. Be like being in one of these sensational newspapers or magazines today. Another effort to curb the practices of sycophants which might overburden courts if someone called a sycophant's bluff and didn't want to pay him off. Another effort was the law that if a prosecutor failed to obtain 1/5 of the votes cast in a trial, or if he abandoned the case after he started it, he was fined 1,000 drachmas. Now, this is a very substantial sum, and it was clearly meant to act as a deterrent. Anyone bringing an eisangelia was not subject to this law, though. Later, the inability to bring the type of case the prosecutor had abandoned or lost by more than 4/5 of the vote cast was added to the penalty. The unsuccessful prosecutor might suffer atimia, in other words, loss of citizenship rights. So this would surely put sycophants off from going after anyone willy-nilly if they face these dire consequences. At least that's what we would think. At the same time, it's to be noted that the Athenians could have imposed far more severe penalties on sycophancy. That they didn't makes one wonder whether they were tacitly viewing sycophancy as a necessary evil to check the activities of potential lawbreakers. I mean, after all, if someone was planning to break the law and was found out, or if someone had committed a crime and was being blackmailed for it, that meant the courts wouldn't be involved. It would free up court time for other trials. Presumably, the sycophants kept tabs on those that they'd successfully caught out before. So a person who'd been a sycophant's victim in the past was unlikely to do anything criminal again for fear of further blackmail. This would have some effect on the crime rate, one would think. So regardless of the scorn heaped on them, the sycophants were perhaps a necessary evil, and they were recognized as that. Now, as we've already said, a victim could accuse someone by a DK if a private matter, or by one of several procedures if the matter was public. Some of these procedures involved a magistrate from the outset, like ephegesis, and others involved just the person bringing the charge, apagoge. The accuser had to make his case to the relevant magistrate, and if the magistrate decided that the right legal procedure was being followed in the indictment and that any witness testimony was acceptable, he would then set a date for a more formal hearing called an anacrisis, a preliminary inquiry, the anacrisis. Now, this was held in the open air and anyone could observe it, so there were plenty of people around to act as witnesses if, say, one of the disputants tried to wriggle out of something later on. Again, we might compare this to the open-air hearing between the two disputants on the shield of Achilles in Homer's Iliad. Now, at the anacrisis, the charge would be read out, and the accuser and the accused would be interrogated by the magistrate. Only after that did the magistrate decide whether the case had merits and that it should proceed to a law court, or perhaps arbitration in the case of a private matter. And if the case was proceeding to a court, then all the evidence that had been brought out at the anacrisis was sealed into urns. And these would not be opened until the trial proper. And, as with arbitration that went to a law court if someone disputed it, no additional evidence could be introduced after the anacrisis. It was during the anacrisis that the person accused could challenge his accuser if he thought he was being prosecuted under the wrong law. Now, given the multitude of laws and procedures, it was entirely possible that someone might accuse another person under the wrong procedure, either by accident or by design. It was then up to the magistrate to decide whether the prosecutor was going about it the right way. But the big question is, what happened if the magistrate didn't know the law well enough? Well, a way to help the magistrate decide which was the best procedure, which was the fairest, which was the right one, was by the use of witnesses. And the use of witnesses was in a procedure called dia martyria, and it was introduced in the 5th century. A witness who claimed to know the facts of the case or about either of the two disputants made a formal statement under oath, and then the magistrate used that statement to decide whether the case should proceed and under what procedure. The big question here, of course, is what if a witness lied? As a deterrent to this, the other party could bring a dike against the witness under a procedure called pseudo marturion. Pseudo, the word false. Pseudo marturion, translated as giving false evidence. And so the charge would be brought under a dike pseudo marturion. The case would then go to a law court. And if found guilty, the witness or witnesses suffered atimia, loss of citizenship rights. So lying was a gamble. Now, while the dia marturia was being decided by a court, the original case was put on hold, by the way. When the dia marturia had been settled, the original case continued. But of course, if your witness or witnesses had been found guilty of giving false testimony, that's detrimentally going to affect the validity of your case, isn't it? Now, at the end of the 5th century, the dia marturia was replaced by the paragraphe procedure. And as a result of the paragraphe, at the initial hearing, the accused man, who thought that his prosecutor was charging him falsely or charging him under the wrong procedure, could bring a suit against the prosecutor. Now, when that happened, once again, the original case was put on hold while the paragraphe was decided by a court. Now, of course, what's happened now is that the defendant in the original case has now become the prosecutor in the paragraphe, or the new case, since he is indicting the original prosecutor. If he won his paragraphe, the original prosecutor had his case dismissed and he lost 1/6 of his property. We can imagine that the process of private individuals prosecuting someone or defending themselves would have been intimidating for many people, given the hundreds that could make up a jury. Presumably, if people were intimidated about talking before their peers in an assembly, they would be the same in a court of law. We should also question how much the ordinary people knew about the points of law. If a person going to an assembly could not expertly evaluate whether it was a good idea to send most of Athens's fleet to Sicily, then that same person wasn't likely to know the ins and outs of law. Now, I've said before that men of the 4th century especially were fairly knowledgeable about current events. There was a lot of street talk going on in Athens. But talking about current events is very different from knowing about the finer points of law. And that's why we see the rise in the 4th century of a group of people called logographoi. Logographoi. These are professional speech writers. These men, for a fee of course, would write the prosecution or the defense speech. The logographoi probably also had expertise in law, so that when a private individual consulted a logographos to write a speech for a particular case, that logographos could also advise on matters of law. So as long as the person had the money, he might not need to prepare his own case. He might be able to leave it to a logographos to do this for him. Now, the litigants could also call on supporting speakers, or synagoroi as they were called, to speak on their behalf in court. Such people would routinely be family members or friends. Now, this recourse, in other words, being able to call on supporting speakers, would be especially helpful if the main speaker, that's the prosecutor or the defendant, was not himself a great speaker, was a bit intimidated or something. After all, everything depended on convincing the jury So performance mattered as much as content, something I'll pick up on in the next lecture. Incidentally, note that the same term sunagoroi is used for the public prosecutors that we talked about recently. So it's the context that determines whether the person is a character witness of a prosecutor or whether he's a public prosecutor appointed by the state. Now, logography was probably a steady and lucrative business, given that Athens was a litigious society. However, the logographos had to be good, otherwise no one would hire him if his speeches kept losing cases. But now let's get to the heretical. You've been waiting for it, I know. I see, in the formal class of logographoi, who charge fees for their legal and writing expertise, and then in the more informal group of sunagoroi, who spoke on your behalf, the origins of the modern lawyer. That is someone who, for a fee, and a big fee, prepares a case from start to finish and speaks on his or her client's behalf in court, if need be. If successful, he or she can build up a large and powerful law firm, and perhaps even attract media attention if the right case comes along. The same is true in Athens, except there were no law firms as such. There were, however, a number of high-profile trials, and many logographoi would have shot to fame and fortune because of them. Some also used their reputation as speechwriters to enter the political arena, such as Demosthenes, the orator. Well, now that we have a basic understanding of the judicial machinery and process, we can turn to what happened at the actual trial. So all that remains for me to say before our next lecture is, see you in court, ladies and gentlemen.